Little Jimi Hendrix here, one of Hunter S. Thompson's favorite artists, contemporary. And we'll be back with Jimi Hendrix later on in the program, as well as selections of music from other of Hunter Thompson's favorite artists and possibly some of his favorite songs. So you're listening to People Rise Up here on KBOO. My name's Andrew Geller, and for the next 54 minutes or so, we're going to have a tribute to the life and work of Hunter Stockton Thompson. For people who don't know, Hunter killed himself sometime Sunday afternoon in his home at Owl Farm in Woody Creek, Colorado, at the so-called fortified compound he lived at for the past 30 or so years. An excellent resource to find out about many things Hunter, I won't say all, is, of course, gonzo.org. It has absolutely no connection to Hunter whatsoever, but it's a fantastic resource and quite obviously a work of deep devotion and love for the man and his work. So I'm trying to figure out exactly what I'm doing with all this stuff here in front of me. I've got like probably 20 or 30 different stories from the past 3 days, each of them with their own little tidbits of just fascinating information about Hunter. And maybe initially I should dispel some myths that Hunter actually spoke of in something I read last night. He was asked regarding his views on guns, weapons, firearms, etc., meshing with his liberal view and liberal politics, to which Hunter responded, "I'm not a liberal." And I think that's pretty clear for anyone who's read a lot of his work. Hunter was a good old boy from the South. He was born in Louisville, Kentucky, and oh, look, if I could just pull it together, I could find all the neat stuff I had about Louisville. But again, I have overwhelmed myself and just didn't have the full time to put it in the order I would have liked.
Could take a drink of this, Andrew.
So Hunter was a writer from the mid late 50s. He actually he wrote in high school, and he wrote stories about playtime events that he and a good friend of his, hey look, it's the thing I was looking for, Walter Kagi, one of Hunter's childhood friends, told E. Jean Carroll that Hunter is very Kentucky. Kentucky is a very violent place. As children, Hunter and his friends played with rocks, bullwhips, and air rifles in the woods behind Kagi's house, terrifying their mothers. A particular fascination was the Civil War, their favorite game being North-South. Both of Hunter's parents, Virginia Ray Thompson and Jack Thompson, were alcoholics, and Hunter, from a very early age, was trouble. There's really no way around that, no way to put it politely. He was arrested a few times as a kid. He was in trouble in school a lot, and basically he served 30 days for I think that was the robbery he did, and basically he was allowed to leave jail early if he enlisted in one of the armed forces, and he went into the Air Force. He entered the Air Force in the fall of 1956, and he began writing for the base newspaper there as a sports writer. A little over a year later, he was discharged, and okay, this is from Gonzo Papers, Volume 1, The Great Shark Hunt, Strange Tales from a Strange Time. Elgin Air Force Base, Florida, November 8, and again, this is 1957. Man Mountain Dents, a novice air policeman, was severely injured here today when a wine bottle exploded inside the AP gatehouse at the west entrance to the base. Dents was incoherent for several hours after the disaster, but managed to make a statement which led investigators to believe the bottle was hurled from a speeding car which approached the gatehouse on the wrong side of the road, coming from the general direction of the separation center. Further investigation revealed that only minutes before the incident at the gatehouse, a reportedly fanatical airman had received his separation papers and was rumored to have set out in the direction of the gatehouse at a high speed in a mufflerless car with no brakes. An immediate search was begun for Hunter S. Thompson, one-time sports editor of the base newspaper and well-known morale problem. Thompson was known to have a sometimes overpowering affinity for wine, and was described by a recent arrival in the base sanatorium as, quote, just the type of bastard who would do a thing like that. An apparently uncontrollable iconoclast, Thompson was discharged today after one of the most hectic and unusual Air Force careers in recent history. According to Captain Munnington III, who was relieved of his duties as base classification officer yesterday and immediately admitted to the neuropsychological section of the base hospital, Thompson was, quote, totally unclassifiable and, quote, one of the most savage and unnatural airmen I've ever come up against. Third went on to say, I'll never know how he got this discharge. I almost had a stroke yesterday when I heard he was being given an honorable discharge. It's terrifying, simply terrifying.
And you know, of course, Thompson wrote that.
You think? I don't know. It's actually. Oh, I mean, yes. Daniel Fless has hosted the Outside World. Chiming in here.
I'm up early. It has all the marks of Thompson. And one of the great things about Hunter Thompson is that he was a great prankster, and this is how you create a myth.
I don't know. It's got the Elgin Air Force Base Proving Ground Command seal.
Of course it does.
You never know. Anyway.
Anybody that's read a lot of Thompson could tell from a lot of the phrases that you had read in that it has the mark of Thompson, the way that he worded himself. Thompson created quite a myth around him, including that he was extremely dangerous on the compound. This is what people do to ensure their safety and their security, and he was a very, very, very private man.
So after leaving the Air Force, he went to New York City, worked as a copy boy for Time magazine for a little while, attending Columbia University. He then moved to upstate New York early in 1959 to begin Prince Jellyfish, his still unpublished novel. Later in 1959, he met his future wife, Sandy Dawn Conklin. He then, in the spring-summer of 59, worked for a short time at the Middletown Daily Record. And he didn't work there very long, and this is why.
I was working for the Middletown Daily Record, and I got in a fight with an advertiser, a gentleman who ran an Italian restaurant across the street because of the quality of his lasagna, I think. And then I kicked in a candy machine because it wouldn't pay off in the candy bars. Yeah, I was fired.
Yeah, well, and there's a whole lot more to that story, and it's a fantastic piece, and I think it's in Songs of the Doomed. I'm not entirely sure. But anyway.
It's good Hunter was a writer, actually, because as you can tell, he's largely unintelligible when he reads. So it's a good thing that he was a writer.
Yeah, he sure liked to mumble. And I don't know if that's anything to do with his alcoholism or his drug use. It just sort of might be a combination of long-term that and Southern speaking style and just his own quirks. Let's face it, the guy was strange. Okay, so he then went down to the Caribbean and South America for a while, and you can read a bunch about that in, there's The Proud Highway, his collection of letters, and I believe, again, there's more of that in Songs of the Doomed, and we'll be doing a little bit of reading from Songs of the Doomed, and a Fear and Loathing piece, I believe. Hunter is probably best known for his work, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which, if I can find the excerpt from the interview, he mentions it was, basically was a story that wasn't supposed to happen. I mean, he was doing something else, but the way he ended up trying to cover the Mint 400 motorcycle race, it just ended up as Fear and Loathing. And that's one of the really fantastic things about Hunter's work, in my opinion, was his ability to, make something completely different out of, it's like he never really stayed on topic, except he did. So I got a little bit of tape here, a little more tape. This is Hunter speaking with, is this the George Plimpton one? I think this is actually, the George Plimpton with the Paris Review. And I'm not sure if we'll do the whole bit here, but this is Hunter speaking regarding the origin of the phrase fear and loathing.
Hunter, the fear and loathing is one of the great titles. Did that come to you suddenly, or did someone suggest it? What's the history of fear and loathing?
I ran into it last night in a 1969 letter. It's a good phrase, for one. I'd never seen it before or heard it. People have accused me from stealing it from Kierkegaard or something. I don't think he was ever that good to come up with the phrase. Think that in that way.
Sindel?
No, I didn't hear it from anybody. It just seemed like the right phrase. First of all, I intentionally used it was Vegas for a title, Fear and Loathing. And once you get that kind of title down, once you see it on paper, There's no way you're going to change it unless you're a complete asshole.
The American dream was to be called that until you change the whole structure of the original.
I think the biggest book was just really a desperate attempt to get off the hook for that American dream, the death of. Everything I came across was part of the same story.
You remember when you changed the death of the American dream into the half novel? You remember that when you did it? Actually, you write Silverman a little bit about it. It's quite remarkable when you do decide that. It's an epiphany, isn't it?
Yeah, but not one that anybody or I arranged or anything like that.
I think you write it, doesn't he? Listen, I've just figured out how to do it. Is that more or less what you're saying?
Yeah, it's like
I know how to do it. It's almost an exclamation.
Well, you're trying from 68, covering Democratic Convention, all these things, trying to look for the American dream, and suddenly that idea of taking, mixing World Duke with that, you know, Vegas story came together.
Yeah, it was a moment of epiphany, but I can't remember what it was.
We should start with Raoul Duke, because maybe when we do this interview, to better, how did the alter ego come about, and why, and when?
Oh, but I keep coming across it in the letters. You know, discussed, dissected. Yeah, I discussed it in letters to Silverman in 69. If maybe that would be the right thing. I know this when I was cutting on my side. I was in the book with Dr. Chuck.
It might be useful for you to describe him somewhere.
Well, he looks a little bit like Lieberman. You know, yeah, it's nondescript for sure. You know, small, thin, quiet, according to the eye, a brutally thieving person. Yeah, seriously, according to Jan, Silverman is the guy that really got off of those 17,000 books.
Well, that's what I thought might be useful.
Well, I'm glad you said that. Because.
Also, Ian Valentine would be interested in
the Yeah, but these were hardcover books.
He's the editor that was moving slowly forward the death of the American dream. The correspondence is wonderful about that. We already talked about that, but what. So he was your editor at Random House, and you kept writing him about how this book was having its difficulty. You couldn't seem to move it, and all of a sudden there's this letter talking about Las Vegas. And could you talk about the genesis of how it became from one to the other? Raoul Duke, you so wrote him on that. Well, first of all,
I started using him originally like when I wrote for Scanlon's, and I would review weapons, police weapons, just like I would do drugs.
You mean you would yourself use this alter ego?
When I was Hunter Thompson, I was the chief magistrate of Woody Creek, as far as they're concerned. That's where a lot of my equipment and my invitations and information came from. You know, the latest gas on the market.
What's the name derived from, Raoul Duke?
Yes, Raoul comes from Castro's brother. And Duke, I don't know. I mean, I don't know when I started using it before, Probably on something like false registration at a hotel or...
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, it all comes from criminal instincts.
I first got into acid when I lived in Big Sur in the early 60s. Mike Murphy and Joanna, a Stanford research psychiatrist, were experimenting with it. The idea fascinated me, but they said, "Wait a minute. There are some people who cannot take acid, and you are one of them. You're the most violent son of a bitch that's ever walked the earth. We both like you, and we probably understand you, but it's just too dangerous for you to take acid. You might kill us all, or kill yourself." Mike had been into weird Indian drugs for a long time, and I gathered that he had to be locked up himself when he took it. He was a pretty peaceful guy, but he had run amok in Palo Alto, so I took their word for it. I stayed away from it then, and I didn't have any use for it for a long time after that. Even later, when I was around Kesey's place, I refused to take it because I figured I might go crazy and do something violent. But then finally I took it down there in a fit of despair the night that the angels showed up. Kesey had invited them down after I'd introduced them to him, and I felt responsible for whatever was going to happen. I thought the angels were going to beat people up and rape them. So I figured, why not just get it on? And I asked somebody to give me a hit of acid. I thought, whatever I do can't be worse than what's already going on around me, so I might as well do it. I can't stand it straight. I took it, and it was quite a ride. I went completely out of my head and had a wonderful time. Didn't bother a soul. Not a hint of violence. I thought, aha! I've gone to the bottom of the well here, and the animal's not down there. The one they said was there. I had a lot of confidence, and you need a lot. You have to give yourself over to your instinct, because with a head full of acid, you can't pull back. You're going to do whatever you feel like doing. You can't repress anything. If you're going to jump out the window, you're going to jump out the window. If you're going to get violent, you're going to get violent. But I didn't. Instead, I usually get very calm. I get into music and talking and laughing and heavy thinking. Images coming, connections. But they come so fast, it's very hard to come back from the trip and still keep them intact. Nobody's really described an acid experience properly because it's impossible to come back to one and you can't really describe it. That's why it's hard to write on mescaline too, because your mind is going four times as fast as your hands can go, and you get disorganized and you can't keep your mind in phase with your fingers. That's why I have to get increasingly fast typewriters. Whatever they make, if it's faster, I'll buy it. LSD 25, Res Ipsa Loquitur. Woody Creek, March 1990. Excerpted from Songs of the Doomed. More notes on the death of the American dream. Gonzo Papers, Volume 3. Yep, scratchy vinyl, White Rabbit off Surrealistic Pillow, another of Hunter's favorites. As I'm beginning to feel as though I'm rapidly running short of time, because we're going to open the phone lines up for like the last 15 or 20 minutes of the show, for anyone who wants to share any remembrances, experiences, impacts, thoughts, whatever about Hunter Thompson. We'll be getting to that in about 15 or 20 minutes or so. Right now, I am going to play a piece of tape that Democracy Now! Aired this morning, which is an interview originally recorded in January of 2003 on community radio KDNK in the Roaring Fork Valley of Colorado. Former KDNK station manager Mary Suma does the interview and begins by asking Thompson about the idea of war being wrong, as well as bordering on insanity. And here's what Hunter had to say.
Of course, it depends on which vantage point you look at the war from. If you're the president of the huge oil company, no, it's not insane at all. It's the war would be quite justified.
How do you feel? I mean, I've read that you were in the streets in the Chicago riots back at that convention. Do you think that we can elicit that sort of passion as it builds? I mean, it really seems to be building out there, the anti-war faction.
Yeah, it does. But look at this. I don't recall, anyway, a massive depression, right. Economic collapse. As in 1968, I was going to say to you, but no, what we have now is a collapse of the economy and a totally unjustifiable war, irrational, really, except from the point of view of the oil industry.
Did you watch the State of the Union the other evening?
Oh, boy, I did.
What'd you think?
I was horrified. Yeah, it was a nightmare of a thing to go through. You know, he rattle off all this, all these pie-in-the-sky ideas in the beginning, none of which are going to either work or be funded. He knows that. Matter of fact, the New York Times today said that already they see that the that his even Republicans are admitting that the Medicare, yeah, his talk about the Medicare plan, the $400 billion plan,
right,
is impossible. Members of both parties expressed doubts about its feasibility today, forcing administration officials to reconsider important elements of the package. God damn. So none of the domestic issues he talked about are feasible. I don't even think he can get the tax cut through, which is insane. Cut taxes in a time when the country is going broke. So over the line, I mean, it's not just the war that's wrong. I can't imagine any justification for just going over to Iraq and bombing the place back to the Stone Age like we did before.
Why does it seem a good portion of the country is buying into this?
That is a really, that's a disturbing aspect of it.
Can we believe the polls? I mean, certainly the applause the other evening, they always say that you can sort of gauge the popularity of a president by the applause at the State of the Union. I don't know if that's true or not. But it seems like we're living in two separate countries.
Well, remember that Bush's popularity and the popularity of the support for the war 2 months ago was much higher. But that's these are just daily. These are things that change every day. But I remember writing it might have been at least 5 years ago. It was ABC, serious poll, and several of them came up with the findings that the American people overall favor giving up some of their freedoms in exchange for more security.
Mm-hmm.
They would rather be secure than free, in other words.
Right.
That really is shocking.
It is shocking. And more so today, maybe.
That's what... that's the answer, I think, for your question is why is the public buying into it? Well, another reason is that the fear, that's what I tried to address or at least rave about in the book, fear is an unhealthy condition, yeah, living in fear. And it, as we clearly have been for 2 years now, it makes the population more obedient, particularly if they're willing to give up their freedom for security, more obedient, more easier to control. And it's, well, it's very much like Nazi Germany, the old good German syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
We used to hate and talk about, and we used to, you know, ridicule it, the good Germans, who just went along with it because that's what the Fuhrer wanted.
You've said the president has destroyed the country, the economy, and the relationship, and our relationship with the rest of the world.
Well, I believe that's true. And even the countries that allegedly go along or support us, our allies going into for this war, popular opinion in most of those countries, I can't say this for sure, but in England, certainly, the English people have, as a whole, are strongly opposed to the war and to going along with whatever George Bush says. Well, democracy is on its last legs in this country, and freedom, the free world, we're defending freedom, we'll fight to the death for freedom, that's absurd. This country is no more a capital or bastion of freedom now than Nazi Germany was in the 1940. This country is a well, a rogue nation in a way, but worse than a rogue nation. We're a war crazy, war dependent, really, nation. And this that leads right to the oil industry. It's ridiculous, and particularly in the media, with the media, notice to not discuss the oil, the connection between oil and bombs in Iraq, is disgraceful. It's, well, Winston Churchill said, in times of war, the first casualty is always the truth. Truth is the first casualty of any war.
In lieu of fear.
Well, you see, I'm a little bit cranked up and fanatical about it.
That's the age group, isn't it, Hunter, that we want to really...
I mean, if you want to live in a Nazi nation, boy, I wouldn't want to be 20 years old now.
I wouldn't either.
I fear for what's coming and for the welcoming committee that's going to... of kids that's going to meet it, saying, come on in. No, it's just ignorance and, well, the media. We're being deprived of the real news. Now, I'm not going to try to say I have the real news, but, just what you said, that's exactly right. Yeah, this is really a disgraceful moment in history, and just thinking about the war and coming, attending peace rallies. So you're going out in the street, voting with your feet, as they say.
That was Hunter Thompson, interviewed January of 2003 by former KDNK community radio station manager Mary Suma. It's Roaring Fork Valley Radio, Colorado. That was broadcast earlier today on Democracy Now! Thank you to them for having that available online.